This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On the last day of its term, the Supreme Court handed down decisions in two closely watched cases. One involves a free speech false advertising case against the athletic footwear giant Nike. The other covers a sodomy law in the state of Texas, where two men were arrested in their bedroom for having consensual sex. In a ruling as decisive as it is controversial, the court struck down the Texas law, effectively voiding similar laws in a dozen other states. Writing for the majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote, "The state cannot demean their existence or control their destiny by making their private sexual conduct a crime." Justice Antonin Scalia, in the minority, said the court has largely signed on to the so-called homosexual agenda and taken sides in the culture war. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. We're going to focus on the sodomy decision for most of this hour, but we want to begin with the court's surprise ruling in the Nike case. The Nike appeal was dismissed on technical grounds. The court said it would make no decision on the merits, or at least not now. Here with us in Studio 3A to help us understand these two cases is Deborah Rosenberg, who covers the Supreme Court for Newsweek magazine, and good of you to join us.
Thank you.
First, the Nike case. Why was this dismissed?
Well, this case dealt with the question of whether Nike could basically defend itself in the public arena. Kasky, a citizen in California, had sued the company, saying that it had had misleading and false statements that were basically equivalent to advertising, as the company was trying to defend itself against charges that it had had bad labor practices abroad.
Third world sweatshops.
Exactly. And so the court basically, you know, although it agreed to take the case, it ended up saying for three reasons that it was dismissing it. First, it said it was questionable whether the case had any federal standing at all. It said that the California Supreme Court had never fully decided the case on its merits. And it also said, you know, there are novel constitutional questions at work here, and we don't want to be premature in deciding them.
Now, the novel constitutional questions part, that would involve what amounts to free speech.
Exactly. Exactly what is really covered by the First Amendment. I mean, when most people speak, that is free speech covered by the highest protections under the First Amendment. But commercial speech has slightly less protection, and advertising falls under commercial speech. But no one's really decided, well, is it advertising? Is it commercial speech if a company just goes out into the public arena to defend itself?
So, in other words, the suit was brought against Nike principally on the basis that what they had claimed in this publicity campaign was false advertising.
Exactly. But that question of whether it was in fact false or not has never been fully decided by the courts. And that's what the Supreme Court was saying, basically.
Now, why, if they were going to punt this back to the state of California, why did they hear the case in the first place?
Well, that's an interesting question. It could be that some of the justices thought this might be less complicated than it turned out to be. Once they got into the nitty-gritty of the case, they thought, you know, maybe we should wait a little while here. You know, it's hard to say exactly why they took it when they, in the end, decided it was too early. But sometimes this does happen. It happens, you know, once or twice a term.
And this does not put the kibosh on the suit. This effectively means that the man's suit against Nike in the California state courts can go ahead.
That's right. And it also means other people thinking of suing other companies for other similar things can also go ahead.
So that will presumably that case will proceed. If there's a verdict, it will be appealed or not appealed and may make its way back to the Supreme Court.
Yes, it could be right back here again.
Okay, but not for a while.
Probably not.
Certainly not today. Let's turn now to the big case of the day, and that's the Texas sodomy law. In this case, this was a 6-3 decision.
That's right. Not the kind of narrow 5-4 ruling that we've seen in a number of these controversial cases, including the affirmative action ruling earlier in the week. We had six justices, Justice Kennedy being the major swing vote here in a way, writing the majority opinion, and then Souter, Breyer, Ginsburg, Stevens, and O'Connor joining with him. And Rehnquist Scalia and Thomas being the more predictable conservative bloc on the other side.
Now, let's go do this chronologically. This actually dates back to a decision some years ago where the Supreme Court upheld sodomy laws in the state of Georgia.
That's right. There was a case called Bowers v. Hardwick 17 years ago, which dealt with a Georgia law. And Hardwick was a homosexual man caught in the act of sodomy with another man. And there was a Georgia law that made sodomy illegal. So he challenged that law, saying, you know, that he felt he had the right to privacy, the right to engage in sodomy. And the court disagreed with Hardwick and upheld the Georgia law, saying that there was no right to privacy, no right for Hardwick to engage in sodomy, even in private. And Justice Stevens, interestingly, was on the court at the time, and he dissented. And it was his view that the court embraced today.
And it's interesting because essentially there were two decisions. The first one overturning this case just 17 years ago. I mean, that's unusual that the court would revisit something so relatively quickly.
It is unusual. And the court, not even just revisiting it relatively quickly, but revisiting it at all and overturning its own decision is pretty rare. I mean, that's something actually that Justice Scalia takes up quite a bit in his dissent, talking about other cases that the Supreme Court has gone out of its way not to go back and reverse, like mm-hmm. Roe v. Wade, for example.
I see. Well, he's got axes to grind, and we'll get to that in just a second. Now, this Texas case arose from a situation in Houston where somebody called the police, and the circumstances of that are murky, and we'll get a diversion from what we're talking about here. But in any case, the police were called, burst into an apartment, opened the door. There were two men having sex. They were arrested.
That's right. And, yeah, the police went in actually on what they thought was a weapons charge, so no one's disputing whether they had a right to enter the apartment. But, yes, they found John Lawrence and Tyrone...
I have the names here, too, but I can't find them either.
That's right. Well, they found John Lawrence and his partner engaged in homosexual sex.
John Geddes,
thank you. And yes, prosecuted them under the Texas law, which was just a misdemeanor. But the men felt this was unfair. And
let me just correct. It's John Geddes, Lawrence, and Tyrone Garner.
Garner.
So those are the two names.
Okay.
I apologize.
Thank you. I was tripped up by the two G's myself. Anyway, the two men were prosecuted under this Texas law. And the Texas law, interestingly enough, discriminated on the basis of your sexual orientation. So the Texas law only made sodomy illegal for homosexuals. It did not make it illegal for heterosexuals. That is a difference from the Georgia law, which had made it illegal for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was the logic of the majority, and what was the logic of the minority?
Well, the majority basically took about the broadest view that they could take in this case, and there were a couple of different ways they could have approached this. They could have said, they could have looked at the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and said, well, you can't discriminate just against homosexuals and say that heterosexuals can do this and homosexuals can't, and you have to have equal protection for everyone. But they actually went further and looked at the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment instead and said, in fact, you know, nobody should have the government, you know, kind of bursting into their bedroom like this. The government doesn't belong there. And they have a right to liberty, a right to privacy under this due process clause, and the government shouldn't interfere with that. So that's a much more sweeping way of looking at the case. Justice O'Connor, interestingly enough, although she agreed with the majority, she did it on more narrow grounds of equal protection.
And in the opposition, among those opposed, as you mentioned, was Justice Clarence Thomas. And he said, first of all, if he was a Texas legislator, he would vote to repeal this law, which he described as rather silly. But on the other hand, he says, I find no right to privacy in the Constitution, and therefore there's no reason this law is unconstitutional.
Exactly. Justice Thomas is one of those strict constructionists of the Constitution. And if it doesn't literally spell it out in there, then you know, he's not going to go for it. But in the majority, writing for the majority, Justice Kennedy said, hey, there are a lot of things that the founders maybe didn't think of when they were writing the Constitution. They didn't spell out everything, and we think this is covered.
And that privacy part also addresses Roe v. Wade, which is, I guess, in some context, a subtext in this. But then, unusually, Justice Antonin Scalia read his dissent from the bench.
He did. I mean, I have heard that on a few other occasions, but his was quite lengthy and quite impassioned, too. He talked, as you mentioned earlier, you know, he accused the court of signing on to the so-called homosexual agenda. He said this was a massive disruption of the current social order. And as I said earlier, he, you know, brought up Roe v. Wade a lot and talked about this idea of overturning precedents and questioned why it was that the court was so unwilling to overturn Roe, but here they were quite willing to overturn Bowers.
The court has taken sides in the culture war, Justice Scalia said. What did he explain what he meant by that?
He said that this decision would basically undermine any law dealing with morals that a state wanted to make. And he said it would have sweeping consequences for everything from gay marriage to gays in the Boy Scouts to even don't ask, don't tell.
This reasoning, he wrote, leaves on shaky, pretty shaky grounds state laws limiting marriage to opposite sex couples. So that's what his concern is?
Yes.
In terms of
yes.
The culture wars. Now, the 6-3 decision, though, in this case and the 5-4 decision overturning the previous case, that suggests to some people that that's, you know, in a way, the Supreme Court's message saying we're not going to revisit this again anytime soon.
Well, that's what this court is saying. You never know if there are new members of the court who appear. They could have a change of heart. But yes, I would agree.
Okay. And the one thing that people said as they accepted this case and as unusually addressing a case that they decided just 17 years earlier was that, in effect, many members of the court felt embarrassed by the decision 17 years ago, and we're looking for an opportunity to overturn it. Times have changed.
That's right. And interestingly, they didn't just say, we now think the Bowers decision was wrong, but they said it was wrongly decided at the time. It's hard to have a much more strong statement than that in repudiating it.
And in terms of the wider implications, not just the vague term, the culture war and the one reference to homosexual marriages or same-sex marriages, were there any other implications brought up?
Well, yes. Justice Scalia, as I mentioned, did talk about, you know, the Boy Scouts. He talked about instances where the government might even mandate discrimination, like in the military, gays in the military. So it's difficult to tell how far-reaching the consequences of this will ultimately be.
Later in the program, we're going to be addressing where some of those consequences may be and the process by which they may be addressed. But right now, Deborah Rosenberg, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Deborah Rosenberg is national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Among her other responsibilities, she covers the Supreme Court, and she was with us here in Studio 3A. Joining us now by phone from Provincetown, Massachusetts, is Andrew Sullivan, who's written and edited several books on same-sex issues, senior editor at The New Republic, a well-known blogger. His site is www.andrewsullivan.com. And good to have you back on the program, Andrew.
Thanks for having me back.
Can we get a reaction to the High Court's ruling today?
Euphoria. A sense of finally we're treated like regular citizens. Finally, we're not this weird group of people that does this disgusting thing in private, but we're actually human beings with families and relationships and dignity. And when Kennedy writes that talking about us, if all that we're about is this sex act, is demeaning to us as people within a society, it's an enormous validation of our human dignity, I think, and the preciousness of our loves and our lives as much as anybody else's. This is not to denigrate in any way the heterosexual experience or heterosexual marriage or the family. We're all supportive of that, but it makes us part of that for the first time and undoes and reverses what I think was, by all accounts, a really bad decision in 1986, which even Justice Powell, of course, who voted to uphold Bowers versus Hardwick, subsequently said he regretted his decision. So it couldn't have been more dramatic, and frankly, I was very surprised that it was so sweeping in its scope and so definitive in its answer.
We're speaking with Andrew Sullivan about the Supreme Court's decision today that struck down sodomy law in Texas and by implication 12 other states where it remains on the books. When we come back from a short break, we're going to take some of your phone calls and emails. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Later in the program, we'll also be joined by Robert Knight of the Culture and Family Institute. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing today's Supreme Court ruling that struck down a Texas sodomy law and, by extension, laws against sodomy in 12 other states. What's your reaction to the decision? Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. We're speaking at the moment with Andrew Sullivan, who's written and edited several books on same-sex issues, a senior editor at The New Republic. And Andrew, you spoke of your sense of vindication at the ruling before, validation. What about the other side of this? What do you make of Justice Scalia's statement that this is the court taking side in the culture wars and signing on to the homosexual agenda?
Well, I think that's putting it rather in extreme fashion. I don't think that is ultimately what happened. What happened was that the court looked at these laws and asked themselves, do they actually promote a legitimate state interest? And Scalia's position was that whatever a government says is morality. It doesn't have to have any rational basis for it. And I think the majority said, no, you have to look and see what this is trying to do. Now, if you said that sodomy, for example, was immoral and should be barred, then that would be one thing, and you provide evidence for why that's a bad thing. But when you allow sodomy for 97% of the population and deny it for 3%, what is that really? What moral argument is that about? And I think what the majority said, the only argument that's about is stigmatization of a group of persons. It doesn't actually have a rational basis. And Scalia's response is, it doesn't have to have a rational basis, it's morals. And I think the court said, no, it really does have to be a little smarter than that. It has to have some kind of broader rationale. And I think the Texas law in particular, because it singled out gay people, it said if you're heterosexual, you can sodomize to your heart's content, and we regard you as having privacy. But if you're gay, we can burst into your bedroom and say otherwise. And that, I think, was what the court majority said. This isn't really about morality, it's about prejudice. And I think that was the distinction that they made with respect to Scalia.
Let's get some listeners involved. Mark joins us on the line. He's on the highway in California.
Yes, Neil?
Yes, hi, Mark, you're on the air.
I appreciate that, and finally an intellectual radio station that covers real issues non-biasedly. Appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much.
And your guest name again is what?
Andrew Sullivan.
I have a couple things I'd like to say. I'm not gay, homosexual, for your benefit, so because I can't look at the issue totally from the gay or the homosexual's eyes. And so my language will probably reflect that also. I have no business in anybody's bedroom, and I don't think anybody does. The problem is, I feel, with this whole issue, is we gave too much publicity to an issue that doesn't need that much publicity. Now, true, like I said before to the young lady that interviewed me, that if a heterosexual was to come and mess with my child, I would be just as upset. I don't care if they were gay, heterosexual, or whatever. And that is going to linger on. That will be true no matter what the situation is. I feel your sex life is your business. I don't necessarily agree with it, okay? That's not your business. That's just how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm being asked,
Yeah, I think that's a sane position. You don't have to have a view about what people do privately in their own homes, as long as it's consensual and between adults. You don't have to enter the culture war on that in order to say, look, let them have their privacy. It's not my role to get in their business, and that's a very sensible position. I mean, I don't think we're asking for people to approve of anything. What we're asking is, let's allow each other a zone of privacy where our sex lives and your sex lives, by the way, are protected. I mean, sodomy laws, you have to remember, go back a very long way, and they always, and what they rooted in was an attempt by the government to stop anybody having sex which didn't lead to procreation. So the sodomy laws we're talking about actually also, until very recently, barred masturbation, oral sex, any sort of sex which wasn't, even contraception, which wasn't procreative. That's where it comes from. And it just so happens that the gay people are the last people to have this thing removed from them, that we all basically now, straight people, sex without having children.
Go ahead, Mark.
Right. Andrew, I feel offended when somebody, I don't care who they are, heterosexual, consequently, most of the people I know, assumably, I guess, I don't know, are heterosexual, although I'm sure I've met a few gay people that I haven't known that they were. But I feel rather offended when they start explaining their sex life to me. Nobody's. It's none of my business. Sure, I'm a human being, and I moderately maybe joke about it, but I don't like to offend anybody. Your lifestyle is between you and God, and I'm not God, so I'm not going to judge you. Again, I find some heterosexuals' sex life rather appalling, and it's none of my business. I wouldn't do it. So whether or not I would do it doesn't make it right. I mean,
isn't that a conservative position? What you're saying is the government should be limited. It shouldn't have the right to come into your homes. It should allow people to make their own decisions about their own morality in private with consenting adults. What's bizarre to me is that that's a very conservative position. It's very small government. It's very privacy-oriented. And I think that's where the mainstream of the country actually is. I want to start talking about this. I'm tired of talking about it.
I think so, Andrew. And I really feel that, look, there was years ago, you're raised a certain way, and you view things a certain way. If somebody comes up to you and pushes you against the wall and go, well, do you believe this? No, I don't. Well, do you find it disgusting? Whatever the issue. Yeah, yes, I do. I find it rather disgusting. Well, would you do it? No, of course I wouldn't do it, whatever the issue may be. Well, okay, you've asked, you got the answer. You know what? Don't ask, you won't get the answer, and that works both ways. I knew a doctor, just as a matter of issue. I'm not, how should I say, if you want to know a little bit about me, yes, I am heterosexual. I appear to be probably more liberal than I am. I don't have a lot of...
Mark, excuse me, Mark, I don't mean to cut you off, but I'm just trying to figure out what is about this that bothers you.
It doesn't really bother me. It doesn't bother me. And it really doesn't. It's just the fact that, let me put it this way. How should I say? I guess you could say that I have a very minute amount of peer pressure that I'm not that... and I think it stems from the fact that I'm an artist, and it doesn't mean that, okay, so I know a lot of gay people because I'm an artist. No, right. That's not the case. And there's a lot, like you say, there is a lot of homosexuals that are sensitive in different areas, more so than probably heterosexuals, I would say. I don't know. I don't want to get into the psychology of homosexuals or gay people, which I don't know the difference. I'm sorry, but or heterosexuals or whatever. I don't care how you believe. But I feel, again, I feel like this. If I had a friend of mine that was a doctor, and I didn't know it, and he was gay. And a lot of people would say, do you think the doctor is gay? And I go, I don't know. I think he's a very nice man, very, very sweet man, very considerate, very, very feeling man. I don't know if he's gay or not.
Okay, Mark. You know? Well, thanks.
And so the point I'm trying to make is I found out later that he was, and didn't really change my opinion. Didn't change my opinion whatsoever. And he says, Mark, I'm very grateful for the fact that you have that you treated me with such respect.
That's an interesting experience, because I think what's also happened in the last 17 years, between the last decision and this one, between Bowers and Lawrence, is that many, many more gay people have come out. Many more people know a gay person. It's much harder to describe gay people as some weird fringe that's doing unspeakable things when people can humanize it. And I think what's happened is the court is reflecting changing culture. It reflects the fact that we're much less uptight about this. We know much more about it. We're more accepting of people as people. We don't see them as doing acts. We see them as human beings. And once you do that, then a lot of this fear and animosity disappears. And I think it's up to gay people to keep that up and to keep talking to people and keep explaining that we're not crazy, we're just like you, And all we want is to be left in peace and private. And that's what this decision was about.
Let's talk now to Michael, who's with us from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Yes, I'm not going to define my sexuality on the air like some callers, because frankly, my sexual orientation has nothing to do with the issue at hand. I would like to succinctly make the comment that I breathed an enormous sigh of relief today upon hearing the ruling of the court, because America, this country, stands for its embracing the plurality of values that we have here and respecting the rights of individuals. And I can think of nothing more profoundly un-American than the sort of cultural hegemony that says that tries to dictate what consenting adults may or may not do in the privacy of their own home. That's my comment. Thank you.
Okay, Michael. Thanks very much. Mm-hmm. Andrew, I wanted to get your reaction to this email we got from Muriel. Personally, I would never base a hiring, firing, pay, housing decision based on someone's sexual preference. However, I certainly agree this court decision continues to move our country to a less moral position. The thing that's always surprised me is I listened to various discussions on the radio regarding homosexuality, particularly when a religious person was speaking, is that no one ever points out that although many sexual acts are forbidden in the Torah, Old Testament, adultery, incest, etc., the only sexual act described as an abomination is sodomy. I'm sorry to see our country going this way.
Well, we have to understand also that adultery is in the Ten Commandments. It has about the highest status imaginable as a moral act, and yet we don't make adultery illegal. We may disapprove of it. We may allow people the right to disapprove of it, just as we may feel compassion for people in that situation. But as a matter of law, we don't make it illegal. We don't get cops coming in your bedroom and saying, you're committing adultery, you go to jail. We used to do that. That was the law in this country for a very long time. And I think this is the same situation. It is not about our public morality. We should allow people to debate that. It's about privacy. It's about allowing people a space within which they can make their own moral choices. And that's what this is about. I actually don't think this is about immorality at all. I frankly do not believe that having sex without having children is somehow wrong. That's my personal view. And I think that most people would agree with that. And I don't think it makes any difference if you're gay or straight. If that is what sodomy is, then sodomy has nothing wrong with it at all. And it should be upheld for straight people using contraception or having oral sex or whatever in the privacy of their homes, just as much as it should be upheld for gay people.
Andrew Sullivan, thanks very much for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Andrew Sullivan, senior editor at The New Republic, was with us on the phone from Provincetown, Massachusetts. He is also a widely known blogger. His blog is www.andrewsullivan.com. Here are some of the other stories NPR News is following today. Israeli troops could soon leave parts of the Gaza Strip under the terms of a security agreement now being negotiated with the Palestinian Authority. NPR's Peter Kenyon is covering that. And the Bush administration and Republicans in Congress are proposing major changes to Head Start, adding more academics to the program and shifting some control from the federal government to the states. Beth Fertig will have that story later today on All Things Considered. Right now, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And joining us on the phone from his office here in Washington is Robert Knight, director of the Culture and Family Institute and affiliate of the Concerned Women for America, which is a public policy organization. And welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, Neil, for having me on.
What's your reaction to today's ruling?
Well, different from Andrew's, I think it was judicial tyranny at its worst, and I've just finished reading Anthony Kennedy's decision. He pays lip service to 5,000 years of Judaic-Christian history, including 200 and more years of American history, talks about cultural impact of religious values and so forth, and the evolution of law, and then sweeps it all aside and justifies this sweeping change in the law based on junk science. He cites the American Law Institute's Model Penal Code from 1955 that was based almost entirely on the fraudulent, discredited research of Alfred C. Kinsey, the sex researcher at Indiana University. This is what the court has become. They're a bunch of psychological doctors working on the body politic, ignoring the Constitution itself, sweeping aside the rights of the people of Texas to make this decision for themselves. I mean, if they don't like the sodomy law, they can have their legislators take it off the books. But to discover this brand new expanded right of privacy, to say that anything consenting adults do in the privacy or in private quarters is untouchable by the government, regardless of consequences, is prone to lead to more trouble, and I'll tell you what that is. Senator Santorum was exactly correct a few weeks ago when he said, yeah, this will jeopardize laws about incest, about bigamy, any laws that regard consensual sex. One he didn't mention was prostitution. I don't see how you could, once you make the central argument to strike down the sodomy law, that there is a right to privacy between consenting adults, the rationale, how can you justify laws against prostitution? For Americans, this would mean, you know, somebody can open up a brothel next door and you can't say anything about it. If you extend it further to just private consensual activity, a crack house should be open next door to your house. And because it doesn't affect you directly, you have nothing to say about it. The reason sodomy laws have been on the books is because they undergird the moral system and the preference for sex within marriage, but they also are a public health measure. If you read some of those briefs submitted to the Supreme Court, the evidence is overwhelming that homosexual sex is extremely unhealthy, that sexually transmitted diseases are vastly disproportionate in the gay community because of these practices, and that the public health aspect alone would give the state a rational basis to have these laws on the books. In fact, the AIDS epidemic really took off in the 70s after states began removing their sodomy laws because this removed protections against semi-public and public sex.
Well, why then?
Clubs opened up, bathhouses opened up, and you know, we ended up with hundreds of thousands of dead men. I don't think that's a good consequence, and I couldn't find any reason to celebrate this decision.
So you would agree with Justice Scalia's assertion that the court, and I have to say, you know, the Rehnquist Court, not usually regarded as a bastion of liberalism, has taken sides in the culture wars?
Oh, no doubt about it. And Justice Scalia pegged it back in the Romer case when Anthony Kennedy accused the people of Colorado of outright bigotry for not wanting to create civil rights based on people's sexual behavior, as if they had no rational basis whatever other than hating gays, which was just a great libel on the people of Colorado. You know, most people really don't care what goes on behind bedroom doors. The court itself, Anthony Kennedy said, quote, laws prohibiting sodomy do not seem to have been enforced against consenting adults acting in private. This isn't about the bedroom police. It isn't about the government coming into the privacy of our bedrooms. We have the Fourth Amendment. We have guarantees against unreasonable search and seizure, and you have to have reasonable cause to come into somebody's house. The cops don't go doing that. And when Andrew Sullivan said, well, we got rid of the adultery laws, too, because we used to have police going into bedrooms, I don't know what he's talking about. Police never did that in our history. And, by the way, the adultery laws, when they went off the books, it sort of created a civil right for adultery, which has shattered many marriages.
We're talking with
an extension of the decline of our moral system.
We're speaking with Robert Knight of the Culture and Family Institute about today's Supreme Court decision. When we come back, we'll take more of your calls on this and explore some of the implications of this decision today. 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, join Ira Flatow on Science Friday for an update on the smallpox vaccination plan. He'll speak with Julie Gerberding, the director of the Centers for Disease Control. That's tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're discussing the Supreme Court decision today that struck down a sodomy law in Texas and by extension in 12 other states that makes it a crime for gays to have consensual sex in their own homes. Our guest is Robert Knight, director of the Culture and Family Institute, which is part of the Concerned Women for America, a public policy organization. And let's get a caller on the line. Luke joins us from San Diego.
Hi, Neil. Thank you for taking my call. Robert, I just wanted to comment on the fact that you had mentioned that adultery, in the context of what Andrew Sullivan had talked about previously, that adultery wasn't something whereby people had to go to jail or were held accountable by the legal authorities. They, in fact, were. And my issue is with Anthony Scalia's response to the ruling as a dissenter, where he talks about this bringing up the issue of gay marriage. I don't understand how it is that heterosexuals are so concerned about this issue when they are not legislating or trying to revert back to no fault, no contest divorce. Because when we got rid in the United States of no-fault divorce, we then basically said that as a heterosexual, you don't have an obligation to explain any longer why you want to dissolve the marriage. And I believe that the reason why it was dissolved was, is that rule was taken away and that legislation was discontinued was because it is against the Constitution, because there is a separation of church and state, and that morality is not the same for everybody who is a citizen of the United States.
Luke, I think and you...
Can I just answer this? It's very interesting.
Excuse me, just if I could clarify, I think Luke misspoke and meant to say that when they got rid of the laws against having sex outside of marriage, those laws. But go ahead.
Well, even called divorce also, Neil, because there, states no longer require you to point out a reason other than irreconcilable differences.
Okay.
When in fact adultery could be taking place in the marriage, and that's the reason why a divorce is taking place.
Well, let's get a response from Robert Knight.
Yeah, I agree with him, but I would say a no-fault divorce has been a disaster, mostly for women and kids in this country. It's split up many marriages. It's cheapened marriage, even for those that stay together. There's always the threat that the partner could walk out and have less repercussions than, say, breaking a business contract. That's one reason adultery was against the law. It was such a serious breach of trust that the state felt it had an interest. And, of course, the state does have an interest in maintaining marriages because it's the crucial institution that holds society together. You can't do without it. It's not more than two people. It's two families coming together. It creates kinship patterns, bloodlines, family names, transference of property. It's the glue that holds society together. And the more we break down protection for marriage in the law, the more we're inviting social chaos. This decision to reach into Texas and say, well, now you have to get rid of your sodomy law, is a terrible example of court judicial tyranny, because they couldn't find a valid constitutional reason. They went into social engineering using bogus science, and they did that with Roe v. Wade, and they've done it in a number of instances. By the way, they quote Roe v. Wade as an example of how they expanded the sphere of privacy out of thin air and then applied it to this case. So they first cite bad law, and then they cite bad science. But this is a bad decision. And if you looking for repercussions, think about this. Children will now be taught in schools that homosexual sodomy is the moral equivalent to what mom and dad do in the bedroom, that there can be no distinctions, and if there are, then you're exhibiting bigotry and hatred. The other laws are at risk, because if the only regarding sexuality, there really is no stopping point if you say consent and privacy are the only variables that we can look at. Forget public health, morals, customs.
Well,
I think communities ought to be able to protect themselves from all sorts of behavior. And if there's a sexual behavior that's costing society greatly, you would try to discourage it, not encourage it.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
If these laws are on the books, presumably, unless you're going to invite disrespect to the law, they should be enforced. How should these sodomy laws be enforced?
Well, I would like to see them enforced the way they were for two millennia, which is in a very benign way, that just as markers, and they undergird other laws against public exhibitionism.
So you're not in favor of police in the bedroom?
Pardon?
So you're not in favor of policing the bedroom?
Nobody is. Nobody I know is in favor of police knocking on the door saying, what are you doing in there? That's not what it's about, and the court even admitted that that is not what's taken place. The case that elicited this challenge was really kind of curious. You know, you had a phony burglary call, you had police come in, and then you had two men engaged in sex who continued, by the way, according to the court record, even after the police came in, which leads me to suspect this isn't your average case. This was set up to challenge the law. This is not what is happening in communities all over America. And, you know, hard cases make bad law, and this is one of them.
Okay. Thanks very much, Robert Knight.
Thanks for having me.
Robert Knight, director of the Culture and Family Institute and affiliate of the Concerned Women for America, which is a pro-family public policy organization. And joining us now is Herman Schwartz, who's an expert in constitutional law and a professor at the Washington College of Law. He's with us by phone from his office here in Washington, D.C. And, Professor, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi.
Is this decision a case of the court jumping ahead of prevailing American opinion or reflecting American opinion?
Oh, I think this is very much reflecting American opinion. After all, the court points out how many states have changed their laws. It's really only a very small handful of states that still have these laws. And they really are a relic of a different time. Mr. Knight's point about 2,000 years or 5,000 years, well, one of the points about a constitution, particularly one written with as broad a brush as ours is that it's supposed to grow with time, that as our values and judgments about what's appropriate change, what we allow and don't allow changes also. That's why the school segregation case of 1890, or the segregation case of 1896, was reversed.
Mm-hmm.
That's why other cases are reversed, because time marches on and people change views.
Here's an email from Forrest in Sacramento. I agree completely with the decision of the Supreme Court on this issue. However, I think it's dangerous for the court to continue to legislate by creative interpretation of the Constitution. Under this loose, touchy-feely interpretation, what would prevent a more radical Supreme Court from interpreting in ways which strike down rather than enhance personal liberty? Legislation should be left to the legislative body.
Well, the fact is that there is a rather, and I don't mean to put it quite so harshly, naive premise there about the way courts decide cases. Our Constitution is written in very broad terms. Interpretation is the name of the game. You can't go by simply the words, Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, for example. We have lots of laws abridging freedom of speech, and it's not just Congress. This was written 200 years ago. It was written intending to last for centuries. These people knew about change, and so they expected that this would change over time, and that's what's happened.
Now, what does this decision, as we look at it, first of all, there are laws in 12 other states. Presumably, they're struck down, too?
Yes.
And how do they do that? Is this now, do the legislatures have to pass a...
No, they're just rendered null and void in the sense that they cannot be enforced. If somebody were foolish enough to try to enforce them, there would be immediately a motion by the defense lawyer to say that this law is now null and void under the Lawrence case, and the case would be immediately dismissed with possibly a prosecution for abuse of process.
What does the decision mean for efforts that would to bring gays in under federal and state civil rights laws?
Actually, nothing. And the decision is uncertain in that respect. On the one hand, you have the narrow question, and the court makes it very clear right at the beginning. It deals with a Texas statute making it a crime for two persons of the same sex to engage in certain intimate sexual conduct. So that's all it's about. It's about the criminalization of sexual intercourse, same-sex sexual intercourse. The language about the importance of protecting this personal right, the importance of respecting the intimacy of both the person and of the home goes much farther. On its face, it does nothing with respect to the civil rights laws. Those would have to be changed. Those would have to be amended by legislation.
We're speaking with Professor of Law Herman Schwartz about the decision today by the Supreme Court that struck down Texas sodomy law. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Professor Schwartz, in his dissent, Justice Scalia expressed concern that this decision could put the institution of could lead to the legalization or recognition of same-sex marriages. How plausible is that?
Well, the short answer is not plausible, but possible. I mean, sure, this recognizes the sanctity of a personally intimate relationship. On the other hand, it does not say anything about the civil institution of marriage, which is a state-regulated matter. And this statute, this decision, is, as you opened your questioning, a reflection of where the country is today. The country is not in favor of same-sex marriages. Probably won't be. Maybe not ever. I don't know. So the Supreme Court moves in a certain direction vis-a-vis public opinion, sometimes in advance, sometimes not as far as public opinion, but it never moves terribly far away. And for that reason, Justice Scalia is the usual Chamber of Horrors argument of the loser. And they all do it.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly Justice Scalia is especially skillful at this.
Now, you said it will invalidate sodomy laws in the dozen other states that still have them. What about the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the military's don't ask, don't tell policy?
Well, that's a very complicated matter because although on its face it might invalidate that, although that's not clear either. And the reason it's not, I guess, is because in every case where you try to extend this decision beyond the criminal context, there will be countervailing arguments peculiar to that situation. Marriage, employment perhaps in a small place, and the military. And there is an unwritten and occasionally articulated constitutional law, an axiom of constitutional law, that what the military wants, the military gets. The Supreme Court has rarely gainsaid what the military wanted. So I would say the likelihood of their doing that is not strong.
It would seem to undermine it, though.
Pardon?
This decision would seem to undermine the military's case.
It may undermine it, but the countervailing consideration is military necessity.
Okay. Does this decision provide any recourse for people who may have been criminally prosecuted for homosexual conduct in the past?
Well, in the few cases where that's happened, one can move to be pardoned. I don't think one can do very much more. One can move to have the conviction expunged. Some states have that for various kinds of minor crimes. Probably not too much, but on the other hand, I don't think that's a major social problem.
Okay. We just have a minute left. Would you say that this is going to be looked back upon as a landmark decision?
Oh, yes. A landmark decision as much for its language as for its holding.
Well, Herman Schwartz, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Herman Schwartz is a professor at American University's Washington College of Law, and he was with us by phone from his office here in Washington, D.C. And there will be more on this decision later today from NPR's Nina Totenberg on All Things Considered. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.